هلو، اتس فرايديز بريتيك شو. ام محمد مكاوي سيتينج فور توني غوزلين for the British show with me for the second hour is labor Oxford economist Martin Summer, and in the first hour we had the councillor for the conservative councillor for Hembury and Braintree, Chris Windows. Martin, we are back for the second hour now, and
so expecting Tony from to contact us from Holland.
Or? Yeah, we are actually. I'm trying him now.
I'll just explain what he's doing, yeah. Shall I?
Yeah,
he's in Holland. There's a seminar tomorrow about the Battle of Arnhem, which, because of course this is the anniversary of the battle on this weekend.
Yeah.
And he's discussing some quite controversial theories that he's been developing over the years about what actually happened in the battle in the 1940s,
yeah.
Which have got implications for what happened in Europe after the war.
So it's Tony Gosling here reporting from a place called Elst in Holland, which is just about halfway between the towns of Arnhem and Nijmegen. Now, Arnhem is probably best known for this big celebration, you could almost call it, because it seems like that. There's some kind of, it looks like a pop concert going on near the bridge in Arnhem this evening. It's very, very rainy here this evening. And that, it seems to be the way that this battle in the Second World War has been mostly celebrated through almost like a massive celebration of victory. And next to me is Dutchman, is Marco Verhage, if I pronounce that right?
Yes.
And he was telling me earlier that he was very surprised when he found out that actually the Battle of Arnhem was lost by the British and won by the Germans. So it does seem rather peculiar that there should be such a big commemoration, which is taking the idea of a massive victory. Doesn't seem to really sit all that well here. Anyway, I'll just ask Marco about Marco, how you perceive this as a young person, this battle to liberate Holland.
Yeah, well, as a young person, I'm from the 70s, I'm from 71, so I must have been about 8 or 9 years old that I found out that this battle was lost by the Allies, the Battle for Arnhem. And that was strange to me, because it seemed like all the attention it was given, that it was a victory.
We've also been looking into some of the facts to do with the battle over here, and it's one of those things. I mean, I wrote an article about it, about the battle back in 2014 for RT, and that article, either people have been very writing to me saying it was very good, or completely the opposite. In fact, there was an article in the National Review, a big US newspaper which goes to a lot of the academics in America, saying this was an obsession too far. In other words, trying to paint me as some lunatic who was just completely fixated on this battle, even actually though I'd only just written this article about it, not a lot more at the time. And it's really a can of worms, because the more you look into this battle, the more I've become convinced that the Allied High Command didn't actually want to win it. So for a start, the tanks that were supposed to come up to Arnhem, the bridge too far, and for anyone that's not come across this before, there's a very good film made in the 1970s called A Bridge Too Far all about it. Those tanks waited for 18 hours after the American paratroopers took the Nijmegen Bridge before they actually started forwards, by which time there was a blocking line which had been put there by the Germans and they couldn't get anywhere. But the fact was that the tanks in Nijmegen waited until 2 hours after the surrender of the British troops in Arnhem before they moved. So that was 18 hours. They had 16 hours to make the 20-minute drive to Arnhem with what the American paratrooper Moffat Burries has described as a corps of tanks. So this is a pretty shocking failure by the British Army to reinforce an objective which had been taken by the paratroopers on the 17th of September 1944. So we're 74 years down the line. And the weird thing about this battle is, unlike most battles, most conflicts, which die away as history moves on, I've been told by the locals here that every year the anniversary is bigger and bigger and bigger. So it's going in completely the opposite direction as you'd expect, particularly strange since it was actually a German victory rather than an Allied victory. So the timing was that at 7 p.m. in the evening the tanks stopped, although they could have made it to Arnhem very easily, and we know that because of the evidence provided by the German commander at the time to British Army Colonel Robert Kershaw. In his book, It Never Snows in September, he publishes the map of where the German troops were, and there was virtually nothing between the town of Lent and Arnhem. So those tanks would have had only a few security pickets, that is to say, untrained men with rifles, in order to stop them. And of course, you can't stop tanks like that. There's also more evidence has come to light about the battle itself, which is the ultra decrypts. That is to say, the Bletchley Park were reading the German traffic, and one of the messages that they have now discovered, that the British Bletchley Park had 2 weeks before the battle, showed clearly that the Nazi communications Field Marshal von Rundstedt and Model, who was in charge of the Western Front in this part of the Western Front, were chatting about the British coming in on paratroopers 2 weeks before the battle. So on the 9th, roughly the 9th, or even a bit before, of September, the Germans knew that this operation was about to take place, which is actually quite new information, and it certainly doesn't fit with the official version of events, which was that they did everything they could to warn the paratroopers. Obviously a big operation like this had to be a surprise attack, the paratroopers coming out of nowhere, but that simply didn't happen. Also, I was talking to Robert Kershaw last week about this, and I actually invited him over, but he was busy. But he's very interesting. He was chatting about the whole thing, and he said he's really rather disgusted with a so-called historian called Anthony Beaver, I think he's spelt B-E-E-V-O-R, who's been published in the Times over the last few weeks, who has a very skewed and twisted angle on the battles. And he has actually interviewed Kershaw, that is, has interviewed the people who are actually involved on the German side and on the British side. So he's got, I think, a much more balanced point of view. But, I mean, we're not just here to talk about and go over to sort of go over old bones from many years ago. We're also here to talk about today. And the upshot of the battle here in Oosterbeek was that there was a series of Bilderberg meetings, which I've studied over the years, which are really meetings of the NATO elites, that is to say the bankers and big business and royalty from the NATO countries, which really do seem to be almost above government. So national governments have to do what they're told these days by the big business, the big corporations and the banks. So can you just tell us a bit about what you've found out, Marco, about the main guy who was involved in both of these things. So he was involved in the planning for Operation Market Garden. There are photographs of him actually looking over the shoulder of Montgomery and Horrocks, the two big British generals. But he was also here at these Bilderberg conferences 10 years after too.
Yes, I think you were talking about Prince Bernhard. And yes, of course, he was involved in both. I've heard some stories, or at least they were told in books, about Prince Bernhard's headquarters in Belgium, where many people just walked in and walked out and were friends with Bernhard and were staying at his place, having dinner with him. And, of course, one of these people was Christian Lindemans, also known as King Kong, who supposedly also got the plans for Market Garden into German hands.
How did he do that? That's not, I mean, easy, is it, really, to somehow leak the plans?
I think Bernhard was very sloppy with his headquarters, maps lying about and people talking. There were many complaints about Bernhard's headquarters, that it was too loose.
Well, let me tell you about one of those complaints, and that was from Ian Fleming, the writer of the James Bond novels, because he would not allow Bernhard to have any kind of security clearance with the Royal Navy, which was his service. Of course, there was pressure on him to give Bernhard security clearance on the British side to buy the King, number one. King George VI put pressure on Fleming to do it, and well, anyway, there were others. I mean, the main one being Winston Churchill, of course. So if you're being pressurized by Winston Churchill, you see, you've got to do what you're told. But the thing is, he was actually paid by the Admiralty, Fleming, because he was in the Royal Navy, and so his paymasters, he wouldn't sell them out, but he did. He did allow Bernhard to have clearance for the army, which was potentially disastrous. One of the things I've done as part of this talk I'm doing here tomorrow, Mohammed and Martin, is looking at the heroes and the villains of the battle back then. So we're going back to the battle again now. Obviously, Prince Bernhard comes top of the list for the villains as the guy who was a former SS officer. He was in the SA. He was in just about everything. He was in the Nazi party. And he was also in IG Farben. I wonder if, you know, Marco, can you say something about IG Farben? This is something which I think it was some sort of gigantic chemical conglomerate, but it was a very powerful cartel at the time, which sort of synchronizes in a way. It's kind of sits quite happily with the fascist system because they ran everything as cartels. Steel cartels and chemical cartels were their bread and butter.
Yes, and these cartels came together, I think, before the war, or when it started, and they had a look at what they could do to save all their investments so that the war would not get that into the risk of losing it. So
well, surely, hang on, one company has got to be on one side of the war or the other. It can't be on both at the same time, can it?
Maybe not to the public, but in secret they are. Yeah.
So they have a sort of one branch on one side and one branch on the other, and it's almost like spread betting, isn't it?
Yeah, that's how they do it. They really met before or just at the start of the war to make this happen.
What about Bernhard amongst ordinary Dutch people now? Is he revered like a sort of... Because, of course, he married into the Dutch royal family just before the war, didn't he? 1937, 2 years before the war broke out, he got rid of his Nazi uniform and he married into the Dutch royal family. How is he remembered now here in Holland?
Yeah, well, he used to be remembered just after the war as the bigger commander-in-chief of the resistance. Our queen, Wilhelmina, made him that at that time. So he was well-known among resistance people to be able to get them weapons or to get them stuff that they needed. So he was liked. He was very well-liked among the resistance. And also through the Dutch media, there was a policy of making Bernhard look good, of course. He was a member of the royal house. So... Bernhard was very popular until in the 70s, of course, the Lockheed affair came out. And that changed it a bit. And then in the years after...
Well, let's just say what the Lockheed affair was, because this is $1 million bribe, apparently.
Yeah.
What for?
Bernhard was supposed to be promoting the aircrafts of Lockheed, and I think it may have been the Starfighter, I don't know, but it was that he would promote for the Air Force, the Dutch Air Force, to have their planes, so he would be paid. And when the Dutch government found out, they made him not wear his uniform anymore, and he got like a slap on the wrist. But they also found out that Northrop Grumman was also a company that paid him a huge bribe. But when they found out, the government, they said, no, Lockheed is enough. We're not going to get more attention to this.
Okay, so he's villain number one. I think he really does have become villain number one, Bernhard, here. And he didn't really seem to care that his legacy might be a negative one. He was having a good time and making a lot of money. So it didn't matter if he sold out his new country and stayed loyal to his old country and to his SS masters from previously. So there are various others. There's this spy you mentioned, King Kong, who came in and betrayed the plan to the Abwehr colonel Kiesewetter down near Eindhoven. And it's quite clear that was definitely a way that the Germans knew that the British and the American paratroopers were coming to Arnhem. But the only thing is, this ultra decrypt rather does change, Marco, doesn't it? I mean, do you think so? That if the Germans knew anyway 2 weeks beforehand, what was the point of sending King Kong through?
I think that they wanted to exclude just going by rumors. So as a real secret service, you want to have several hooks and lines in the water to catch the fish.
Yes, certainly. The other one of the villains list, we'll get through the villains as soon as we can, because the heroes are much more interesting, really, is Frederick Boy Browning. His vanity and his reckless errors throughout the battle seemed to be beyond incompetence. He even took whole headquarters into Nijmegen. I mean, for a start, Browning went to Nijmegen. Why did he do that? Because the main objective was Arnhem. It's almost as if he knew they were never going to get to Arnhem. If he was a real commander, a real leader, he would go in with the spearhead, at least close somewhere to the spearhead, so he could lead the battle. But he didn't. He went further back. And also, he's... transfer after the battle was to the Far East. Immediately after Arnhem, he was sent out to the Far East Command, as far away from Britain as they could possibly take him, with one of the Mountbatten, I think it was. He was working as, that's right, he was a batman for Mountbatten out there. So they wanted to get him well away from the UK because he was getting a lot of criticism for having totally failed to do this battle here in Arnhem, and also failed to bring in reinforcements. They were offered several times. They said, do you want some more men, or have you got enough? He said, no, everything's fine here. So he was a treacherous guy. He was just lying. He also lied to the soldiers who were under him in the 1st Airborne Division by saying that by not telling them, for example, John Frost, the colonel who was at the bridge, wasn't told that the Nazi units were nearby. It was the first he knew was when the tanks rumbled down the road. He was pretty annoyed about that he hadn't been told by his intelligence officers. So there are a whole bunch of the villains, but the real interesting ones, I think, are the heroes. There's obviously Colonel John Frost, who got to and held the Arnhem Bridge in the face of overwhelming odds. Also, guy who I spoke to a few years ago, Captain T. Moffat Burris from the 82nd Airborne Division, a very smart, brave soldier, and always challenging his inept superiors. He was the guy who went up to Lord Carrington, and he was sitting on his tank at the bridge in Nijmegen, put his Tommy gun against Carrington's head and said, get down that blankety blank road before I blow your blankety blank head off. So it wasn't the generals, the colonels, the majors, it was Captain Moffat Burris that did his very best to get the British to actually go and rescue the lads in Arnhem. And let's face it, they had 16 hours to do it. A Sherman tank does about something like 25 miles an hour. I've looked at this, they could have been in 20 minutes, they could have been down to Arnhem. I've driven that road a few times while I've been over here. It is not far. And as I've said, was hardly anything in the way. Sergeant Robinson is another one that comes in for a lot of applause, really, because he was the first one over the bridge. In other words, very, very brave, because the Germans were going to blow the bridge up. So if you're sitting in a tank and you're sent over that bridge and you know it's about to be blown up, it's quite a brave thing to do. It's not going to be very easy necessarily to survive in a tank on a bridge that's being blown up at the time. So he was quite brave, and I think he got fired up when he got to the other side in Lent towards Arnhem intact without dying. I think he then started firing, he started shooting, and he managed to get through almost all of the German defences, just him and his mates and his tank and one other tank. They took out almost all the German defences that were trying to stop the rest of the corps getting to Arnhem. So he cleared the way for everybody else. The only trouble was there was no everybody else. The rest of them didn't come. So Sergeant Robinson comes in for a big pat on the back. Also, General Stanislav Sosabowski, he was the Polish commander. I've an interview which we'll pay in the next few weeks. I spoke to one of the veterans who knew Sosabowski very well, parachuted into Arnhem with the Poles, and he was adamant that what they really wanted to do is they didn't really want to come here. They wanted to go to Warsaw because the Warsaw ghetto uprising was taking place at the same time. And the British said, oh, no, we've got a much more important job and we haven't got the airplanes to take you to Warsaw, but we can bring you here. And what did they do? They dropped them in a place where they couldn't really be of any effect to the battle. So the Poles were extremely irritated, and they are irritated to this day about the way that the British Army dealt with them. And Tony Hibbert, who I interviewed a few years ago, he was one of the British soldiers at the bridge in Arnhem from the 1st Airborne Division, 2nd Battalion, the Parachute Regiment. He issued, before he died, a request to the British Army, please fully exonerate Sosabowski, who was used as a scapegoat for the failures of the British generals, particularly Browning and Horrocks. The day.
I've got a point about General Sosabowski. The Polish were indeed, they got the blame for losing the battle. What I can add to that is that our Queen Beatrix, a big Bilderberg name as well, it was one of the last things I think that she did, that she gave the Polish parachute regiment the highest military medal in the Netherlands. So they were given that, and that was quite recent. I don't think it's that far away.
Well, that's good, because it's appalling to leave it 74 years after the battle to let this kind of running sore with the scapegoating of the Poles carry on. So also, I think it's probably also worth looking at, one of the things I'll be doing in this talk tomorrow I'm doing over here, folks, is the looking at some of the legacy today. Actually, it's one of the things when I phoned up to book the venue, the people at the venue said, well, this is all very well talking about this old battle, but what about today? And of course, they're quite right to point that out. The 1st Airborne Division was one of the key, well, it's actually the Parachute Regiment, was key over in 1972 in Northern Ireland in the Derry Bloody Sunday massacre, where those soldiers shot dead 14 Republicans and officially began 25 years of civil war in Northern Ireland. So they're not really shrouding themselves in honour on that occasion. I also thought it was interesting to look at the 82nd Airborne, the 101st Airborne. What are they up to now? Well, I don't know about now, but the 82nd Airborne Division trained a guy in Korea not long after the war called James Files. James Files was a hitman after he left the army for the Chicago mob. And he was hired to, as part of the team with Charles Nicoletti and Johnny Roselli, to go down to Dallas to kill the president, JFK. So the 82nd Airborne Division trained the guy that blew John F. Kennedy away. And in fact, he was the guy that fired the fatal shot. It's pretty clear now, if anyone bothers to look at the evidence. And I'm hoping that Wim Dankbar might be able to come down tomorrow to give a short presentation and to sell his book, JFK Murder Solved, down here in Oosterbeek tomorrow. Also, 101st Airborne Division, well, that's much more up to date. Marco, I don't know what you make of what's been going on in Ukraine. Can I just ask you that?
Well, in relation to the 101st Airborne?
No, I'll talk about the 101st in a minute, but Ukraine is a flashpoint, it seems now, between East and West. We were promised, weren't we, that NATO would not come close up to the Russian border, but they're right up against it now.
Yeah, of course. What springs to mind to me as a Dutchman is the MH17 case, of course, where we got Dutch Prime Minister taking responsibility, as he would say, in saying we will get to the bottom of this case. And the next thing he did is he said the Ukraine government, of course, is not a suspect.
Well, that's strange, because it all happened under Ukraine airspace. The air traffic control of that, were the tapes have never been released, although they have a transcript. We don't have the original tapes from which the transcript would have been made. Also, the aircraft had its altitude and flight path altered by the air traffic control in Ukraine, northerly, so it meant that it would go closer to the war zones. So there's definitely suspicion around the Ukrainians. Anyway, the intriguing thing that I discovered about the Ukraine coup back in February, was it 14 or 15? Crikey, I think it was 15. Anyway, in the Maidan, was that the commander who was brought in to run the mercenaries who'd been brought from Latvia and Georgia, and two of those appeared on film, and in fact I'll put a link on our show page to the film which includes them. They testify that the guy who was running that operation from the Hotel Ukraine to kill Bearcook police and civilians, 50 of which were killed, that I think it's 48 or 50 were killed that day, shot from the Hotel Ukraine the day before the coup, the day of the coup, were being trained by a or were being ordered around by a soldier from the 101st Airborne Division. So I don't think we're really, it's it, you know, that these modern day versions of these so-called heroic people from the Second World War, of course the airborne people tried as hard as they could, the ground troops let them down, and really covered themselves in glory. Anyway, look, I think we'll wind up, guys, because I'm sure you want to talk about the Russian airliner, the Russian aircraft that was shot down this week. You have a good old chat about that. It's to talk to Marco a little bit about the activism he does here by doing something I think is an incredibly valuable, useful piece of work, because the mainstream press simply do not do it anymore. That is to stick a camera in the faces of the rich and powerful, particularly politicians who are supposed to work for us, and ask them a few awkward questions.
Yes, of course, that's what we like to do. We started out as We Are Change when we got from Rotterdam. We were Occupy Rotterdam at first, and our mayor, Mr. Abu Talib, he took away our tent, so we could no longer be Occupy Rotterdam. So that's when we decided to become We Are Change Rotterdam. And at that moment, we thought we're going to do all the things that the mainstream media does not do. And we didn't think that they confronted politicians in the right way. So, yeah, we're still doing that. And we've been to what we call Prinsjesdag. It's when the government shows us what they're going to do this year. We go there every year, now in the seventh time in a row, to ask these people. I also asked the Minister of Defense. I asked her 2 days ago about Assad, about those two chemical attacks that were blamed on Assad, but then the proof was that the rebels did it. And she said that next time there will be an attack like that with poison gas, that she thinks that it should first be really investigated before reacting militarily. So I said, well, I'll keep you to that. I don't see that on mainstream media.
No, there's a lot of things that they don't seem to report on mainstream media, aren't there? How have you managed over here in Holland with the so-called populists, though? That's one of the things that intrigues me. We've got Brexit in the UK going on, and there seems to be, in many parts of Europe, particularly in Italy, Greece, a movement against Brussels. What is the right wing like here? The national, I shouldn't really say right wing. I mean a kind of nationalist movement, anti-EU movement. Is it really part of the far right? Is it racist as well? Or is it just simply a movement to separate from Brussels? Or is really nobody thinking like that over in Holland?
A really good question, thank you.
It's a bit too long, that question, wasn't it? Okay, off you go.
Well, it has several aspects to it. First thing, I think that people who are being called populists are usually the ones that want to do what the population wants. The ones that call themselves Democrats are the ones that don't want to do what the population wants. That's my first impression. If I look at the right here in Holland, of course, we have our the party who is in power, the VVD. They are a right party, but they usually associate themselves with entrepreneurs and business-like people. Of course, there's Geert Wilders, who has his really anti-Islam party. He's on the right as well. And then there's a new party that's being formed. They call themselves Forum for Democracy, and they are the competition for Wilders because they are more focused on a wider issues, not just anti-Islam, and they are more anti-EU. So that's sort of the spectrum of the right in Holland. I do have to say that none of them are nationalistic. Nationalistic, I think, is not really Dutch. I think other countries can be nationalistic, but the Dutch, they always piss on their own country. I'm sorry.
But what do you mean by that? Why?
We don't have a strong tradition in nationalism.
And is that because, you have lots of neighbours and you don't want to upset the neighbours?
I guess so. Also, the trade. We like to think that we are not so important, but the trade is very important with other countries. Yeah, that as well. And what I see as nationalism here in Holland is the national football team, or the royal family here in Holland is also something that is viewed as something nationalistic. But when you go and have a look at it, it's not. It's superficial.
What do you think the Dutch people are thinking about Brexit? Do they think the English are mad?
No, I think that a majority of people would want the same for Holland.
Really?
Yeah, that's what I think.
They're never going to get the chance to the vote on that, are they?
No, they had a few referenda. So I think they had two referenda about the EU. And in both those referenda, the people said no. But then the government came on television and said, we did not explain this the way that people would understand that they would have to say yes.
One of the things that I'll think is just about wind up now, though, is just to run through some of the questions I'll be asking, because this is the thing I feel we don't get questioning media. I don't know what you think. I often sit at the TV thinking there's a few obvious questions. You're not asking them, guys.
Yeah, no, they're not. They have an agenda. They're not supposed to ask certain questions. So.
Really? What agenda is that then?
Of keeping us informed about one thing so that we make our decisions on that one thing. All the other things that also would influence your decision, they're not telling you.
Well, on RT they say question more, but they don't seem to question Putin quite enough. I'm not sure. I mean, yeah, they don't. They simply don't. I mean, you see very, very little criticism of him. In fact, in a piece I did on RT years ago, they edited out the bit where I was talking about their opposition, and when they put it on YouTube, this whole section of my interview I did had gone. I was talking about the real opposition being Ziganov and the Communist Party, and that little section was gone. I think the idea is that the opposition doesn't exist in Russia, only Putin.
Yeah, that's true. And then on the other hand, he's a really good opponent to the evil West.
Well, the questions I'm going to be running through tomorrow are things like, how did the Nazis find out the paratroopers were coming? Well, I gave you a preview of that. Who gave permission for a former SS officer to help plan Operation Market Garden? That's Bernard, obviously. How did the Dutch-born British Army counterintelligence officer nearly save the day? This is a guy called Colonel Pinto, who was working for the British Army, although he was Dutch right the way through the war. And then after D-Day, he spotted the guy, King Kong, just before Operation Market Garden, and the Dutch spirited King Kong away so that poor old Pinto couldn't get his hands on him, which does make you wonder whether the Dutch were in on this whole business of the King Kong spy going to leak the plans to the Abwehr down in Eindhoven before the paratroopers arrived. It's amazing. Sometimes I think it's amazing, Marco, that the paratroopers did as well as they did when there seemed to be so many things conspiring to stop them. Particularly, you know, they're facing tanks with just a few Sten guns and basic light weapons. Then also, who really cut the wires and stopped the Nazis blowing up Nijmegen Bridge? That's pretty... I'm pretty... convinced about that. The timing seems absolutely clear about who did that. Why did this 100 British tanks, which could have relieved Arnhem and the Oosterbeek Hexenkessel, the Witch's Cauldron, grind to a halt in Lent? Because this is what the pocket of isolated airborne outside Arnhem in Oosterbeek were called, the Hexenkessel, the Witch's Cauldron. Also, the angle we haven't mentioned that much really so far is, where did around $1 billion the Nazis had looted from European bank vaults disappear at the end of the war? Because this was the key thing, I think, in the background to the Arnhem battle, was that you had something like a month before, something called the Red House meeting in Strasbourg, where the Nazi industrialists were basically all agreed and signed up to the plan to survive the war. And so deals were being cut between these incredibly wealthy industrialists on the Nazi side and some of the top people amongst the Allies too. So it's quite feasible that the Operation Market Garden was sabotaged for that very reason, is that deals were being done. They wanted to extend the war another 5 months, is the way some people put this this battle down to including people who were there, like Tony Hibbert and Oreste Pinto, say the war could have been over by Christmas 1944 if the British had crossed the Rhine and got down into the Ruhr, had that bridgehead. It would have been potentially decisive, getting the war finished by Christmas 1944. So this deal of looted cash, I mean, that must be potential. Anyone who's about to lose a war is going to be using that to try and bribe some of their adversaries for safe passage after the war. Also, a very interesting subject, I think, anyway, is which Germans were at the first Bilderberg meetings, because it's since transpired that a lot of these were senior people in the Nazi superstructure, although those coming along to those early Bilderberg meetings didn't realise that. Including Joseph Abs, I think is his name. He was one of the chief people in Deutsche Bank, and his job was to go through the accounts of the Jews to sequester the money, to take the money away from Jews during the war, in order to just steal it, literally, for the party. For that, when he was there at the Bilderberg meeting, I think it was 1956, a couple of years after the first one. Which was dug out by Manfred Petrich from All Smoke and Mirrors. He's found some fascinating facts out about who these people were at these first Bilderberg meetings, particularly the Germans. And what are the consequences of losing in Arnhem been for the post-World War? Well, I think this is really about the rise of an organised criminal network right across the West, really, where they buy up politicians, political parties, and they buy up the media too, in order to make sure that there's no public, anyway, criticism of them. So 74 years on, what has come to light about the real heroes and villains of Nijmegen and Arnhem? And so that's what I'm going to be really looking at tomorrow in this talk. And I've also been interviewing quite a few people whilst I've been here, including some veterans too from the battle. There's not a lot left, they're mostly going. I'll leave the final word though, before we get back to the studio, to Marco, which is a bit of a responsibility, but I'm sure you'll manage it, which is, what is the message, do you think, for people today to learn from the battle here and also from the subsequent meetings at the Bilderberg Hotel, which we were at earlier having a snoop around there? They've just got a new, if anyone's ever over this part of the world, very swanky. They've got pictures of is it Paul Reikens from Unilever, Henry Kissinger in the foyer. They're very proud that this is what they started, even though it's organised crime. So what's the message, do you think, now for the battle in the war and also for the subsequent Bilderberg conferences?
Well, what I think is that when people just go through the mainstream history, you get a very superficial story. It all turns out to be very simple, and that's the way it is, and that's what you should think. When you dig in deeper and you go and ask questions and you go to archives and you interview people like Tony did, that's when you find out there is much more to the story, and sometimes it's the other way around. It's not what the mainstream is telling you. And that's what I find with the Battle of Arnhem, but also with Bilderberg.
And you have to actually come here to go and knock on the doors to talk to the people. It's a sort of geographical thing as well. A lot of the journalists nowadays, they just sit behind a desk, they never go anywhere. Anyway, Marco Verhees from We Are Change Rotterdam, do you want to just give your website and your YouTube channel?
Of course. Yes. Our website is wearechange.nl, and you can have a look at us. We have about 400 videos on our YouTube channel, which you can find under the name We Are Change Rotterdam.
And from Tony Gosling here in Lent, the place that Lord Carrington and his tanks could easily have got to within about 10 minutes if they'd trundled up the road to save the lads at Arnhem Bridge, but for whatever reason chose not to. Back to the studio in Bristol.
Yes, thank you, Tony and Marco. Live from Holland, Martin.
I imagine what will happen next week, Mohammed, is we're going to discuss some of the things that he's discovered while he's in Holland. Yeah. We've had quite a big field of discussion there.
Yeah.
And I know quite a lot about this because I've been working with Tony on this research for many years.
Yeah.
And of course, to boil it down, what Ian Fleming's unit within the Royal Navy was in contact with people like Bormann, who was second in command of the Nazi Party from the beginning of the war.
Yeah.
So there were negotiations going on, and Bormann was very senior, and he basically controlled access to Hitler.
Okay.
And of course, basically Bormann, according to John Ainsworth Davis, who was a under Fleming, he was extracted from Berlin at the end of the war.
Okay.
And then put into Argentina by British intelligence.
Okay.
And of course, the reason they did that for him is because he knew where all the money was.
All right.
And all the money was then put back into Germany. And the head of the German secret services after the war was a guy called Reinhard Gehlen, but he had been the head of the Gestapo before the war.
So that's the money which is they steal it from.
Yeah, that's the money they'd stolen.
Yeah.
And of course, so all this money, there's a great big pile of money there.
Yes, and of course,
they said to the people at the top in the West, "Do you want this money?"
Okay.
And he said, "Yes, we do." Said, "Well, you can have it, but the deal is this." And of course, they wanted. Don't forget, the Soviet Union was coming from the other side, and they needed to basically set up a structure with reliable Nazis to resist what they saw as communist threat.
All right.
And of course that's underlying all of this. And of course the Bilderberg group met in Arnhem. That Bilderberg hotel is in Oosterbeek, just down
that's
the road.
Where it is,
and of course senior people from the Nazi side and from the Western side were both at this conference in the 1950s, including Bernhardt, who's mentioned there.
He
was in the Nazi party, and then he supposedly changed sides.
Yeah, yeah.
But of course, the suggestion is that he was an intermediary with certain Nazis. Yeah? Not all of them.
Not all of them.
Certain people.
Certain people,
The ones who had control of the money.
Okay.
Yeah? Anyway, there's a huge story there.
Wow.
But of course, it's not. It's pretty well known. Operation Paperclip.
Yeah,
they took plenty of ex-Nazis to America.
Yeah.
And they lived. You know, Wernher von Braun, who invented the V2 rocket.
Yeah.
He helped to develop. The missiles for the Americans.
Yeah.
But it was also not just scientists.
Yeah.
It was also intelligence officers like Reinhard Gehlen. Because
okay.
Gehlen said, "Look, I've got all these spies in the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
Do you want those spies to work for you?"
Right.
He said, "Yes, we do. Actually, now you come to mention it, well, you can have that. You can have my network, but you've got to make me." And he was made the chief.
Yeah.
And the current head of the German secret services has just been sacked by Angela Merkel because he was. He was basically saying that the far right were not really a threat and that he didn't really think there was anything to look into there. And, of course, this is still a threat. And, of course, they've always had this... it's a big secret, but not so secret in Germany, that lots of senior Nazis weren't at all punished.
Okay.
They carried on being very senior people after the war.
Yeah.
And, you know, pretty much everybody knows that. It's not really a huge secret.
So, as I say, we'll
cover that next week. Well, maybe we need to talk about
what's going on,
which is the shooting down of the Russian plane.
Exactly. Yeah. What's going on?
Well, I mean, obviously, I've been trying to follow what's been going on, as you do. But it seems that everybody is of the opinion that the plane was shot down by Syrian air defences.
Okay.
But the Russian military are saying that it was the Israelis are to blame because they used the Russian plane as a cover for their attack.
Okay.
Yeah. So when the Syrians fired back, they hit the Russian plane, and they
thought. So they thought it's Israeli
because of the radar.
Yeah.
The radar profile.
So they thought it's Israeli.
The Israelis fired lots of missiles into Syria, about 200 missiles into Syria.
But they
waited till the Russian plane was there, and then they fired the missiles so that the Russian plane's in the way. And when the Syrians fired back, they hit the Russian plane.
Okay.
And the Russians are pretty clear. The Russian Ministry of Defense said that they blame the Israelis for this. Putin has been more, because as he's very diplomatic, he said, "Well, we'll have to look into this. It's very sad, but the Russian military were pretty clear that they blamed the Syrians. They blamed the Israelis for it. Mm. Yeah, and they also suggested that a French frigate had fired a missile
from the sea.
From the sea, yeah.
Okay.
But the French deny it, but the Russian military say, well, we saw a missile come from that from that ship. And of course, what's just happened in Idlib is that Putin and Erdogan have agreed a ceasefire and a potential political solution.
Yeah.
And of course, that's the way the war has gone on for such a long time, because everybody's negotiating even as they fight.
Yeah.
So of course you should do that. I mean, that's
exactly
in any war.
Yeah.
Even if you're killing people, you should talk to them.
Yeah.
Because it's the only way. Because if it can be settled, without a fight, then that's good for everybody, isn't it?
Exactly.
But of course, the situation is very tense this is superpower confrontation.
Yeah.
And there's potential for just to spiral out of control.
Yeah.
And if the Russians were to overreact, for example, and shoot down an Israeli plane or sink the French ship, which they could do. If you're going to shoot at us, we're going to shoot at you.
Yeah. So
and then, of course, bang, you're off.
Yeah.
It's all.
What's going to happen after that.
But I think what makes me feel calm about this is that the Russians don't overreact.
They're just
being calm.
Which is good.
And of course, they're trying to talk to Erdogan. The Americans tried to overthrow Erdogan with this military coup.
Yeah.
And the Russians, who were very hostile to Turkey, they said, look, they gave him a warning, which has probably saved his life.
Yeah.
Because they were trying to kill him.
Yeah.
They weren't just trying to get him out of the government. They were going to kill him.
Yeah.
And I think that Erdogan at that point owed Putin.
He
owed Putin. Because Putin's like, even the PKK in Turkey, who were fighting for autonomy for Kurdish region, they opposed the coup as well, because they said it's not for the Americans to decide who should run what goes on here.
Yeah.
And I think Turkey's a very important country because they are there because of the geography, but also because they've got relations with everybody, and they could choose to move more to Iran and Russia rather than working closely with the West. And that's the politics of the situation.
Yeah, so the balance is
there. It's like a Rubik's cube that's being constantly moved around. Nobody's permanently a friend or an enemy. This is Middle East politics. It's politics in general.
Yeah, it is.
And there's usually more than one side. I used to be an aide worker in Bosnia during the war.
Yeah, yeah.
And I knew there were three sides. Serbs, Croats, and Muslim Bosnians.
Yeah.
But when I got there, I realised there's about 10 sides, because
Yeah.
each of these three sides have got different groups who can do deals with other groups in any of the other two major formations.
And same was happening, it was happening in Afghanistan and
everywhere.
Yeah.
Civil wars aren't straightforward where you have one side fighting another side.
Yeah.
You've usually got at least three and probably usually more. And of course, that makes it very much more complicated. It's not black and white.
Yeah.
It can't be black and white. If you've got more than two sides in a conflict, then inevitably it's going to be more complicated than people think.
Yeah. So, because we coming to the end of our show, there is a clip about a regular visitor to Lebanon from Bristol, and she's talking about Lebanon and Hezbollah. Her name is Diana Carroll. So we'll listen to it and we'll talk about it before the end of the show, okay?
It's a terrorist organization. I think some of the Western countries do as well. Who are Hezbollah?
I think all of them.
And
do.
Are they really terrorists?
Well, they came out of the civil war. I mean, they began in the civil war. They were, they haven't been around. I think it was 1980, really. And Nasrallah, the leader, started up the political party. I think originally to combat the Amal movement, who was not doing much economically for the Shia population there. And even though he was a kind of fundamentalist back then, he had a point. I mean, a lot of my analysis of the Civil War kind of comes down to the factions being the Maronites fighting each other, the Shia fighting each other, and the Sunni not fighting each other. But it's quite interesting. I mean, they did fight each other as well, but, there was a lot of interfighting between the factions.
Now, Hezbollah is a political party. It's also an army. Mm. It also does provide some social services, doesn't it?
Yeah, it provides social services.
Which is, I find, fascinating. We don't really have anything quite like that over here. Mm. You know, that you've got a political party that provides social services and also has an armed wing.
I think the thing in Lebanon is all the different religions, they all provide a social service. They, yeah, it's not just central government.
So this is things like welfare payments, kind of for hospitals. What is it they provide?
This, the school uniform in Becker Valley is a blue. And I think people I've seen on the internet that people call them the Scout Movement, but they're actually the school uniform that the, you know, the kids.
So you're kind of buying into the political party as much more than just a political thing. It's also almost something that is very close to your family and with you through life, I suppose.
It is, and I think it's not what really angers me about the West is the fact that they only do report. You know, they only do acknowledge that. Hezbollah are a state within a state, whereas all the different cultures and religions are a state within a state. Until recently, it has really changed over the last couple of years. I've noticed myself.
How?
Well, it's because they've started pulling together. And Hariri was kidnapped in Saudi, wasn't he, in the wintertime or whenever. And he came back. They're all in Nasrallah. They were all begging him to come back because they're kind of sorting stuff out. I mean, for the first year of the first years of the Syrian civil war, Lebanon was not at war. I was there in 2013. There was bullets going off everywhere, bombs going off everywhere. There was posters of Bashar al-Assad in Koula, which is a region in Beirut. And it was very kind of interesting. Everyone was bullet dodging. The following year, it kind of got a bit better. But by 2015, the Russians had come to talk to Hariri, sent an ambassador over, and I think he gave the heads up to go into Syria, basically because of their knowledge of Islamic State had actually kind of increased. And they realised if they got invaded, even the Sunni didn't want such radical people in their country. So at first, Hariri backed Islamic State, and then he changed his mind. And now he's very friendly with a Maronite family called the Frangias, who are family friends of the Assads. So it's quite interesting. And Hariri was actually kind of promoting him to stand for president, but he didn't want to.
So what is his role then, Hariri?
He's the prime minister and he's leader of of his party. I think that's the future party.
Wasn't there one of the Hariris that got assassinated or something? By a drone or something?
His dad got assassinated. They're still doing the inquiry. They don't know who did it. They accused the Syrians. The Syrian troops withdrew from Tripoli in the north, where there's a lot of Alawites. They withdrew the troops from there. And that's why he was left in disarray. From 2005 to 2013, 8 years of gunfights every single night, and I heard them myself. So it's kind of it's interesting because I don't think it was the Syrians, and now I don't think the Lebanese government think it was the Syrians, because it would have been a silly move.
Yes, Martin.
Well, obviously, that sort of reinforces what we were saying before about how complicated civil wars are. Mm. Because you've now got, for example, Hezbollah is in alliance with General Aoun, who's the president, who used to be their enemy in the 1970s.
Yeah.
And, of course, it sounds as if it's terrible, but in actual fact, the fact that people who are enemies can make friends and become allies is also a sign of hope. It's a possibility to discuss any conflict and resolve it if the will is there on the different parties involved in Lebanon, in Afghanistan, in Syria, anywhere. And that's the only hopeful thing I can see in all of this.
In this note, we ending this show for this week. Next week, Tony and Martin will be with you. And we'll continue with you after the news of 8 o'clock with my regular show, Rabbi Salam Africa. I've been with you, Muhammad Makawi and Martin Summer. And our thanks as well to...